you've got a Bible, turn with me to Judges chapter 4. We took a week off last week. It just sort of hard on an Easter Sunday morning to come to Judges. So not even I figured I could pull that one off. So we kind of took that week off. But now we're back at it here in Judges chapter 4 as we continue to work through this book. And I've said this pretty much every Sunday. If you're visiting with us, we just ask that you keep coming back. We're not always in stories like this. This is just this part of the Bible. So there's 66 books in the Bible, written over an incredibly long span of time, written by about 40 different authors that fit together in an incredible unity. And they take the form of poetry. Lots of them are history. Judges, one of those 66, is a bit of a different thing. Recording a period of history that is extremely unusual, and yet I think needed for me. If for no one else, it's needed for me. And so we've been spending a few weeks here and a few more months to go. As you can tell, we're only in chapter 4. We got a ways to go. Let me just make sure I'm also in Judges 4. There we go. I think I grew up, although I'll probably have debates after with some of you, I think I grew up sort of in the golden age of superheroes, long before like green screens and fake things, because they don't seem real to me anymore. Like I grew up, they were real people with body paint. It was just so much better. And I have lived long with the weight of one particular story. It's sort of in our family. And every time we get together, it seems it comes up. It did recently. So it's been fresh on my mind as I come to Judges. And that is my fascination with the Incredible Hulk. Who, if you don't know the Incredible Hulk story, he's David Bannister who gets shot with gamma rays. And so then he turns into the Hulk when he gets angry and helps people. It's a wonderful story. He's kind of like the littlest hobo, for those of you who are going like, who's he? He's like the littlest hobo. Less fur, more green paint, and he shows up and he helped people, and it was a great show before the fake one of like recent years. Lou Ferrigno, anyway, for those of you who don't know it, go look it up on YouTube. Pretty spectacular entertainment from the 70s. Anyway, I had the awesome opportunity when I was about five or six, to actually go to Universal Studios, where Lou Ferrigno and the Incredible Hulk lives. So that was where his house was, I think. And in a room, kind of like the outdoor, sort of a rounded stadium kind of thing, slope floor, get to actually meet him. And I wish I could say that I did that well. I didn't. And this is where the funny story in our family comes in. It's like, haha, remember that time when you saw the Incredible Hulk and you burst into tears? It was so hilarious for the rest of us. But it didn't diminish sort of my love for that era of superheroes. Because there's something inside of us, isn't it, that just, we're all looking for a hero. We're just kind of wired that way. And as a society, we can't let go of it. Even with the cheap knockoff versions of modern computerized. But we turn everything into that. Like it seems like even most shows on TV now they've morphed into turning people, elevating them to hero status. So we take shows and we put people on a stage and we watch them sing. We pick out the hero. We take chefs. I'm not so much into that show, but right, we put them in a kitchen and say, you start baking and we're going to choose one of you. We're going to exalt you to hero status. I looked up some of these online. There's shows that I just can barely even believe they actually exist. There's one called Sheer Genius, where they take barbers and put them in a room to cut hair, and we're going to choose one of you and exalt you to the status of you're the genius of the whole thing. We just can't seem to stop. My favorite show, although it was better in first service because there's more of our Irish contingent, it's actually called, this is a real show, it's called The Great Escape. Here's the premise. They take Irish families who want to leave Ireland, which apparently is most of them, and then they compete to see who can form a better life. I kid you not, a real life. Have you guys seen this? Some of our Irish people know. They're in denial. It's like, it doesn't exist. And yet they're here among us, probably with secret cameras trying to win, right? Because we want to see, like, who's the hero of Ireland? But here's the sad part of the whole thing. As quick as we want to elevate them and take people and say, look at this person. This is like a hero. There's that sad broken part of us that seems to just be as quick to want to rip them down. And we almost seem to take as much delight in watching them fail as we do in building them up. And as we come to Judges, there's that tug of war that goes on inside my heart, in all honesty, because these are flawed, imperfect people. And the whole time as I read through the book, I'm reading it through the lens of saying, am I supposed to imitate this person? Am I supposed to commend them to you and say, look at this person and imitate their pattern of life? Or are we supposed to pick apart the sins of their life and say, don't imitate them? Like, what do we do with all these different characters? And I think that's part of the point. It's exposing the humanness of the whole thing, that we would come to the end of our rope and say, there's only one man who is flawless and perfect. And it's not the Incredible Hulk. It's not any of that. It's just Jesus. And yes, the Bible holds up many men and women as examples for us to learn from. But all of them are flawed. And to do Judges well, we kind of have to hold that strange tension. Even this morning as we come to a chapter like chapter 4, where we're going to meet three individuals who are really held up in different ways, but all of them still broken. And so hopefully together we can do this well. Now, chapter 4 and chapter 5 of Judges, just so we kind of know how this is going to work, we're going to take 2 Sundays to do this. The reason is chapter 4 is going to give us the story of what takes place in the life of Deborah, Barak, and Jael, these three figures. And then chapter 5 looks back at the story in a song format. So it's the same events, but just kind of two different chapters, sort of looking at them in some ways from almost like from two different perspectives, which is, I think, going to be helpful. Next week, we're going to kind of wrestle with the next perspective of chapter 5. But this morning, our goal is simply to walk through the story, make sure we understand what's happening in the text here in this chapter. And I don't want to try to pull out, I'm going to go for four things that I think we should be applying in our lives based on this. Four things that just, in my mind, so clearly connect, even though we're talking thousands of years later, just clearly connect right to my own heart that I need to be learning out of this. So that's our aim here this morning. And I'm going to, instead of just reading through the whole thing, I'll just kind of read a few verses, talk through those, read a few more, talk through those. By the time we get to the end, we'll have hopefully got our heads kind of wrapped around this part of Judges. So here we go, chapter 4, verse 1. The people of Israel again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord after Ehud died. And the Lord sold them into the hand of Jabin, king of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor. The commander of his army was Sisera, who lived in Harosheth Hagoyim. Then the people of Israel cried out to the Lord for help, for he had 900 chariots, and he oppressed the people of Israel cruelly for 20 years. Sadly, it sounds familiar, doesn't it? It doesn't sound like, it's like, oh wow, this is new. No, it's not new. That's the point of Judges. We just keep coming back to the same plot line where no one's learning anything. No one's stopping sin. They are saved by God for a brief period of time. During that time, they have peace and they have rest. You would think that people would look at that and say, you know what? We like peace. We like rest. Why would we ever go back to our sin? And yet, every story begins, and the people of Israel again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. And I wish I could say, isn't that strange? Like, wow, what an unusual thing. And isn't it good that we aren't like that? Except you and I both know, this could be our story, it could be my story, where God does great things in my life, allows me to see things, saves me, and then I find myself right back in the same broken things again. Hopefully making progress, Lord willing, thankfully, yes, but not totally done with sin. It's still there, hangs on. And here we find this people back at the same spot they've been to before. They know this spot well. This time, though, we have a new king, a new situation, and we're introduced to some of the characters of the story. Firstly, we're introduced to the king, Jabin, who, strangely enough, won't really feel like a main character in chapter 4. He just sort of is introduced at the start. He's ruling a city that we thought was destroyed because it was back in Joshua chapter 11. The city of Hazor had been already destroyed, burned to the ground, and now it's been rebuilt. And this man has the same name as the guy back in chapter 11. Did I just lose Mike? No, I'm good. Okay. Same name, and so most historians figure it's probably either a title or a family name. Maybe you've got a family name like that where you name, you're up to like, you know, in our family the name James keeps reappearing, so lots of us have the middle name James. It's possible possible Jabin is a name like that. So we've met a guy who, you know, 150 years later still has the same name and has now rebuilt the city. And from this city, he has begun to control the nation of Israel because the Lord did something. This is not the story of a powerful king who overthrew a weaker, powerless people. This is the story of God saying, if you're going to rebel against me and choose sin, there's going to be a consequence. It's a strange consequence because there's even mercy in it. There's a discipline in it. That God is going to call his people back through something this difficult. Now, we meet a second character pretty quick here, and he actually starts to seem like the main bad guy in the story, a man by the name of Sisera, who, the odd part of him is the name is not a Canaanite name, it's actually a Philistine name. So if we were to sort of speculate, it sounds like Jabin, the king of the city, Hazor, has hired himself a mercenary by the name of Sisera, who happens to command an army with 900 chariots of iron. We're at the start of the Iron Age, so that's kind of a notable thing. Up to now, people didn't have chariots of iron. Actually, by chapter 5, the song version of the same story, when they sing about this back in chapter 5, verse 8, the lyrics of the song go something like, Israel didn't even have shields and spears. So they're going up against an army outfitted with 900 iron chariots. And they don't even have weapons, it seems, at their disposal. I don't know what the parallel is. The example, probably a poor one in the first service. The most advanced military technology I can think of is like, not sure what the latest version of the F-15 or 16 or whatever, up to 18 or 32. Anyway, some powerful jet fighter. Can you imagine if I said to you, okay, this afternoon, you've got about 3 hours, go home, whatever's in your garage, put together the best weapon you can come up with, and then you're going to go against an army outfitted with 900 F-16s. You're going to get the sense of why this seems so impossible. Because it was. Militarily, what you just read there is impossible. The story should be that they were oppressed for 20 years and forevermore, because an army can't go up against 900 iron chariots. It just doesn't work. And yet, we come to the end of verse 3, and we see God begin to do something. He raises up the next judge. And it seems to be described almost in casual terms. I'll put it that way. Now, let me read for you what happens here in verse 4. Now, Deborah, a prophetess, the wife of Lapidoth, was judging Israel at the time. You catch that? We've now met a woman who is a prophetess, and I mention that because it's noteworthy. It's a rare thing in the Old Testament. There's three of them. And not only is she a prophetess, but she's a judge. She's judging Israel at that time. God's raised up this woman. And I opened all sorts of cans of worms in the first service, and I'll do it just one more time, and then I will retreat with my tail between my legs. There's been lots of discussion over the years, certainly the years I've been pastoring, of like the role of men and women in the church and how we navigate that. And there's all sorts, even within our church, I get it. There's all sorts of different views and opinions, all those kind of things. A lot of times Judges 4 is held up as a text saying, read Judges 4. This is a key one, because here God raises up a woman to lead the nation, and he does. And so let me just open this can of worms just a little bit further. Clearly, she is a key leader. You can't deny that. There's no runaround. There's no way that you can just say, we'll just set this story aside. God raises up a woman who is a leader of the Lord's people and a judge over Israel. But, so now some of you are squirming. But, let me make the rest of you squirm. This will be fun. All of us will be squirming together by the time I'm done. But the whole point of the chapter is not, look at what God did. He raised up a woman to lead. The whole point of the chapter is, look at the failure of a man named Barak, who should have been leading. And I think that's a difficult thing we need to all grapple with. I really do. I don't think there's easy answers to these things. Because the whole rest of the story is going to be, when God needed the military leader, he doesn't send Deborah. He sends Deborah to say to Barak, Barak, remember, God told you to raise up an army, and you've failed, so get to work. And at a bare minimum, guys, it probably means this. We don't get to avoid leadership. I don't know what else to do with it, or how all the other pieces. I'm much too simple of a man to figure all that out. But that much I know. That followers of Jesus Christ, those of us who are followers of Jesus, who are men, are supposed to lead. And when we fail, God will do whatever He needs to stir, to remind, to recall. But we don't get off the hook. Barak will not get off the hook. He will lose the glory, but one way or another, God is going to get him to do what he's called him to do. Okay, close the can of worms. We will pretend that never happened. No, I'm kidding. Here's how the rest of the story progresses. I'm in verse 5. She used to sit under the palm tree of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel in the hill country of Ephraim, and the people of Israel came up to her for judgment. Now, for us, that almost means nothing. It just sounds like a geographical description. She's sitting under a tree in the middle of nowhere. If you were an Israelite when this is happening, that meant a whole lot, because that meant she's sitting out under a tree just outside of the city where the priests who are supposed to be leading the people and ministering were ministering. And they're not doing their job. And God raises up this woman and plants her just outside the town and says, Deborah, you're going to do it. If they won't, you will. She sent and summoned Barak, the son of Abinoam from Kadesh Naphtali, and said to him, has not the Lord, the God of Israel, commanded you? Go gather your men at Mount Tabor, taking 10,000 from the people of Naphtali and the people of Zebulun. So these are the two tribes that are in the area where Jabin would have had his kingdom. So Barak somehow has already heard from the Lord. That's the implication. This is not the first time. Deborah's coming along saying, Barak, remember, you already knew this. God had already somehow spoken. You knew you were supposed to do this. You've failed, and I'm here to remind you. God is through me speaking. That's what a prophet is. Get the authority of the Lord to speak. Go do what you were supposed to do. Gather your 10,000 men, take them to Mount Tabor, which is about 12 miles away from where all the action's going to happen, and do what God has commanded you to do. Has not, that's the verse, has not the Lord, the God of Israel, commanded you? Verse 7, and I will draw out, this is her speaking on behalf of God, here's what God's going to do. I will draw out Sisera, the general of Jabin's army, to meet you by the river Kishon with his chariots and troops, and I will give him into your hand. God says, here's your part, Barak, just show up. In some ways, the battle is verse 7, isn't it? The battle's not what comes next. I mean, there will be a battle. It's not described in a lot of detail, but it's coming. But it seems to me the battle is just that moment of obedience. Do I really believe that if I led 10,000 men out to Mount Tabor, that God's going to show up and do his part? So often that seems like the battle. Do I really believe God enough that I will do what he's asked of me to do? Do I really believe in him enough that I think he's going to come through on his part? For all of Barak's failings, which we're going to get to in a moment, the thing that I think leaves him commended to us, because he is commended in Hebrews 11, that list of here's all the great people of faith, he shows up. I think it's because of what happens next. He actually goes out and does what God asks him to do, with some flaws, and we're about to hit that part. But at the end of the day, he does it. He is obedient. But here's the flaw. Verse 8, Barak said to her, if you will go with me, I will go. But if you will not go with me, I will not go. That's kind of a little bit like yes and no. Go out, yes and no. Like, I'll go under these conditions. What's strange about those words is they're the exact words that Moses spoke way back in the Exodus when he was leading the people. And God said, Moses, I'm not going anymore. And Moses came to God and said, God, if you don't go with me, I'm not going to go. Barak quotes Moses. And we wish he said it about God. That would have been so great if Barak had said, you know what? I'm not going to go unless the Lord goes with me. We would have said, well done. That's actually probably a praiseworthy thing to say. But you notice that's not what he says. He says to Deborah, Deborah, I'll go on one condition, that you go with me. Now, people wrestled with this little issue because you could take it one of two ways. Some people say, well, he's a coward. He wants Deborah to go. He's not going to go unless she goes, and somehow that doesn't seem right. Other people say, well, actually, maybe there's a good side to it. Maybe it's an indication of the humility of this man, that he's actually willing to submit himself to the woman who's speaking on behalf of God. After all, who wouldn't want a prophet with them, right? If you're going to go into battle, it seems like having the person who can speak on behalf of God there might be a good thing. And scholars have spent hundreds of pages, I've read actually a bunch of them this last couple weeks, trying to wrestle with this whole thing. The problem is actually verse 9 solves it. You don't need hundreds of pages, because Deborah actually tells us kind of her assessment of the whole thing. Here's what she says in verse 9. She said, I will surely go with you. Okay, fine. If that's what it takes, Barak, I'm going to go. Nevertheless, the road on which you are going will not lead to your glory, for the Lord will sell Sisera into the hand of a woman. In other words, Barak, it seems like here's what she's saying. Had you just gone and obeyed the Lord, you would have had great glory. People would have looked at you, Barak, and said, you were the judge. You were the one who delivered us. Let's sing a song about Barak. But now, you will go, and you will fight, but you're not going to get the glory. Instead, God's going to give that into the hand of a woman. Now, without looking ahead, and I know some of you probably already know the story or read the story, it seems to set it up as though we already know who the woman is. It's Deborah, right? She's the judge. She's going to get the glory. A little bit of a spoiler alert. There's actually going to be one more person introduced. We haven't met her yet. That God will bring in who will get the glory in the end, a woman by the name of Jael. So let's keep reading. We're going to meet here in a moment. Halfway through verse 9. Deborah rose, went with Barak to Kadesh, and Barak called out Zebulun and Naphtali to Kadesh. About 10,000 men went up at his heels, and Deborah went up with him. So we got the scene, Barak leading 10,000 men with Deborah, going and doing what God finally had asked them to do. Then we get this little interruption called verse 11, which is going to become important at the end of the story. Here's what it says. Now Heber the Kenite had separated from the Kenites, the descendants of Hobab, the father-in-law of Moses, and had pitched his tent as far away as the oak of Zananim, which is near Kadesh. And then the story carries on, where we're going, what does Heber have to do with anything? Hold that thought until about verse 17. He's now been introduced. The Kenites, by the way, chapter 1 introduced us to them. They were not Israelite, but they had allied themselves with Israelites, so they were kind of traveling with them, settling the land together. But we find out in verse 11, there's one branch of the family that says, you know what? We're actually going to join Jabin and Sisera. We're going to ally ourselves, not with Israelites, but with these other Canaanite people. That's going to become important to how the story ends. Verse 12, when Sisera was told that Barak, the son of Abinoam, had gone up to Mount Tabor, Sisera called out all his chariots, 900 of iron, and all the men who were with him, from Harosheth Hagoyim to the river Kishon. And Deborah said to Barak, up, for this is the day in which the Lord has given Sisera into your hand. Does not the Lord go out before you? So Barak went down from Mount Tabor with 10,000 men following him. I find that moment right there pretty spectacular. It's about 12 miles of plain from the mountain where we're described to the river that Sisera has lined up his chariots. And God says, here's the strategy. Remember the safety of the highlands where the chariots probably can't really be much advantage? And where I've got you to gather, I want you to now run down the mountain, run 12 miles through the plain into the face of an army of 900 chariots. And he does it. And he's got flaws, and he's a broken man, just like the rest of us. But that, my friends, is faith. That's obedience. Forever commended in Hebrews 11. And I don't know, we get lots of things wrong as a church. Oh, but I hope the one thing we get right is that when God says, go, we go marching headlong into whatever the Lord tells us to march into. That we would obey him in that kind of way. That day the Lord routed Sisera and all his chariots and all his army before Barak by the edge of the sword. In chapter 5, it's actually going to describe how that happens, because it seems like, how did an army of 10,000 rout an army with 900 chariots? We're actually going to find out in Judges chapter 5 that God caused a flood out of nowhere. not unlike the situation of God leading his people through the Red Sea, causing the Red Sea to part, and actually the same language, the route, that same word shows up there when God throws Pharaoh's chariots into confusion and chaos. That's the word chaos, same word here. And through that, God, he gains a great victory. Now, here's the only problem. Sisera got down from his chariot and fled away on foot, and Barak pursued the chariot. So kind of in your mind, you got the picture of there's been a great battle. Sisera goes left, he runs, he leaves his chariot, he runs. Barak does what? He follows the chariots. Chariots are fleeing. Barak and his men go that way. If we kind of knew the place names, we'd see one goes right, one goes left. One goes east, one goes west. They're heading in the opposite directions now. It seems like we have a problem. How is Barak going to defeat Sisera? That's what the rest of the story is about. Verse 17, Sisera fled away on foot to the tent of Jael, the wife of Heber, the Kenite. Remember them from verse 11? We meet them again. He comes, in other words, to a tent belonging to an ally of his, presuming he's going to find safety, find that great Middle Eastern hospitality, where they're going to care for him and not do anything to him because they're allies, and he's supposed to have hospitality. For there was peace between Jabin and the king of Hazor and the house of Heber the Kenite. And Jael came out to meet Sisera and said to him, by the way, do any of you know how this story is going to end? Hands up for those who know the story. A few of you. All right. This is, okay, so lots of us. Because in the first service, it seemed quite shocking over the next few verses. I'm not sure if it was just early in the morning or exactly what the situation was, but it's about to get a little bit interesting here. Jael came up to meet Sisera and said to him, "Turn aside, my lord. Turn aside to me. Do not be afraid." If ever there was untrue words, those are them. He should have been very, very afraid right about then. So he turned aside into her tent. She covered him with a rug. He said to her, "Please give me a little water to drink, for I'm thirsty." So she opened a skin of milk and gave him a drink and covered him. Which sounds like the action of most of our mothers maybe growing up. Tucking us into bed, puts a nice warm blanket, here's a cup of milk. Come in, come in. There's nothing to fear. It's like some sort of crazy old nursery rhyme thing, right? It's like, yeah, we're going to put you in a cage and eat you. He said to her, so this is her, so she's, by the way, chapter 5 actually recounts this part in even more detail. Isn't that great? He said to her, "Stand at the opening of the tent. If any man comes and asks you, 'Is there anyone here?' say no." That will become ironic in just a moment because she's going to kill him. There will be no one in the tent. That's kind of the point. It's actually, the verse is supposed to be ironic. We just don't always catch these things in English. So, say no. But Jael, the wife of Heber, took a tent peg and took a hammer in her hand. This is actually, it is actually ancient women's work. So the women actually did set up and tear down the tents. So when they were nomadic people, this was not, the men weren't putting up the tents. The women did that. So probably she's pretty familiar with a tent and a peg. These are kind of tools of the trade. She takes a peg and took a hammer. She went softly to him. Again, sounds very motherly. Then it changes. And drove the peg into his temple until it went down into the ground while he was lying fast asleep from weariness. So he died, which is the most understated statement of the whole story, because if you have a tent peg go through your head, you will die. I once slightly broke my jaw. I think I maybe even have told this story before. I was GTing. I was young and foolish. Not young enough, but young-ish. And GTing down a ski hill, jumping over a jump into a parking lot in the dark on New Year's Eve. Seemed like a good idea. I no longer recommend it. But going down, the one time the GT ski hit a rut and my face hit the side of the icy jump and I slightly broke my jaw. And I learned at that moment, it's actually not an easy thing to break your jaw. Like, I didn't have to have it wired shut. It's actually a, like, bones and stuff. It's hard. And as I tell you that because I've been thinking all this week about this scene. I think it's good to apply our thoughts. And I don't mean in like some sort of gory, grotesque way, but pondering this woman. This woman walks into a tent with the leader of a foreign army who is noteworthy for his cruelty, I'm sure for his bravery in a twisted, broken way, for his military prowess. Takes a tent peg and a mallet, hovers over him, softly, we're told, and I don't think could have touched him, because that would have been my instinct. It's like you want to place it and then hit. Had to suspend it and then whack it through his head. And the courage. Just ponder the courage of that sometime. In all honesty, just the sheer nerve and courage of this woman. I mean, yes, it's brutal and bloody and all those kind of things. Don't ponder that part. It's no wonder that by chapter 5, here's what they will say of her. Most blessed of women be Jael, the wife of Heber the Kenite, of tent-dwelling women most blessed. He asked for water, she gave milk. She brought him curds in a bowl. She sent her hand to a tent peg, her right hand to the workman's mallet. She struck Sisera, crushed his head, shattered and pierced his temple. Between her feet, he sank, he fell. He lay still. Between her feet, he sank, he fell. Where he sank, there he fell, dead. They sing her a song. And in, interesting enough, also in chapter 5, she is included in a list of judges. Shamgar and Jael, chapter 5, I think it's verse 6. Are praiseworthy people. Here again, we run into this problem of the complexity. Is she to be commended? Certainly the application is not women, go home, get yourself a tent peg and a mallet and keep it under your bed. So what do we do? What do we do with these scenes? Or is it commendable to sneak up to a man who's in your tent where you've told him it's going to be safe? And then you've killed him. You see the complexity. This is the complexity of the whole book, where we're not sure what we do with these people. Do we hold them up as heroes and say, look at this great person, look what they've done? Or do we say, hold on a second, this is barbaric and murderous, and certainly we're not saying the application is you learn how to kill people? That's the complexity of Judges, where we're left saying these are broken people, and nowhere, notice, are her actions commended anywhere. They sing a song of her, but it's not like they said, you know, God told her to do this. She's actually not Israelite, right? She's a pagan person who kills another person. And yet somehow in all of this, God's at work. Now next week, we're going to try to unpack that a little bit more by chapter 5. Because chapter 5 looks back at all this and does help us make a little bit of sense. For today, I just want you to consider four ways that I think we need to connect the dots from this to our lives. And husbands, you'll be very glad. None of them have to do with tent pegs. I bet you her husband that night had a hard time sleeping. I've also been thinking of that this week. I bet you he went to sleep with one eye open. I'm going to make sure you're snoring before I fall asleep. That's not one of the applications, but here they are. Number one is this, and it's the application of the whole book of Judges over and over and over again. And if I preach Judges and don't mention this application, you really haven't preached Judges. So here it is. Be careful of the craziness of the cycle of sin. Like, I don't think we're ever, even as followers of Jesus, knowing we're forgiven, knowing the Spirit's in us, knowing He's at work within us, I don't think we're ever supposed to take the cavalier, careless attitude to sin where we look and go, well, I would never do that. I would never do what was evil again in the sight of the Lord. In fact, by the end of the book, it tells us the reason they so often did that is because they were doing what was right in their own eyes. It was evil in the Lord's eyes, but it was actually right in their eyes. They didn't make a choice and say, look, we can do what's evil in the eyes of the Lord or what's good in the eyes of the Lord. Let's choose what's evil. Nowhere does it say they made a decision to do what's evil in the eyes of the Lord. Everywhere it says it was evil in the eyes of the Lord, but they decided to do what was right in their own eyes. And in that, I see a massive warning for us. That it is conceivable for them and for us to come up with a different definition of what right is. And to do it fully convinced that we're doing the right thing because we haven't tested it against the truth of God's word. Never once does it say they did what was right in their own eyes and they held it up next to what God had revealed to them and tested it. They just said, it feels right, we'll do it. It took God to come along later and say, it wasn't right. You see, we have God's word. We know what right is. We can test our actions according to it. We have the Spirit who helps us, who guides us and teaches us. And the most fearful thing to me is that it suggests that it's possible that even among us, sitting here today, that there could be some of us who are doing what is evil in the eyes of the Lord, but we're fully convinced it's right. And I would just call you to carefully examine anything in your life that might at all be questionable. Because we don't want to find out one day that we were living contrary to what was right before the Lord. That's the first application. The second two are a package deal. I see them kind of fitting together. Oftentimes, I think we go hunting in Scripture. We read Scripture looking for ways that it will address our felt needs. So, has anyone heard of the expression felt need versus a real need? A felt need is something you perceive, right? It's like, I feel like I need lunch pretty soon. I hope service is almost over. It is. A real need might be the actual thing that you need deep down. You don't feel it or perceive it, but it's very, very real. And sometimes we come to Scripture looking for Scripture to meet our felt needs, which usually for me are encouragement and joy and hope, and it's all there. There's lots of that there. I want the victorious stories. I want to know we win. I want all those kind of good things. That's why I love places like Joshua. It's like, it's full of great stories where it's victory. I like Nehemiah because like he builds stuff and it feels like they're winning. I like David for all of his flaws. There's lots of good, hopeful, encouraging stuff. I love Paul in that regard. I mean, when he proclaims the greatness of Jesus, it's victorious, it's fantastic. But most of my life, and most of your life, is not spent figuring out, how do we celebrate all the great victories we're currently experiencing? That's not the predominant experience, is it? Most of our life is, how do I survive in the muck? Facing all sorts of gross, challenging obstacles. And how do I just make it through today and conceive of making it through the next day? And see, Judges is all about that. Judges is for people living right there. That's why I think this book is so pertinent. Now, if that's true, here come the next two applications that both fit under that. Number one would be something along these lines. We need to be very generous with each other because we are not predictable people. Over in Job 23, we find out that God is unchanging. It's a characteristic of God's being that we don't nearly exalt in enough. That means he is faithful. We sang of it today. That means tomorrow he'll be the same as he was today. He's never going to change. But you see, you and I, we might. One moment we're doing well, the next moment we might not be doing well. One moment we speak truth, one next moment we might not. And we go back and forth and we waver. We are changing as opposed to God who is constant and unchanging. That's why we praise him for his faithfulness, because we know we're not. And if we're going to live together as people in a church family, we better be gracious to one another. Because that means probably all of us are going to have days where we don't do very well. And if we hold each other up to a standard that says, if you're not perfect all the time, if you're not totally truthful all the time, then I'm going to put you in a box called a liar. If you're not totally reliable all the time, I'm going to put you in a box called unreliable. Eventually, all of us are going to end up in the broken box. There'll be no one left who's perfect. And I think it's a good reminder as I read through Judges and I see all these broken people who one moment are heroic and victorious and the next moment doing strange, sometimes sinful things. It's a reminder to me that we need lots of grace with each other. Let's make sure we extend much, much grace to one another. Then, the second one under that is the problem of kingship, and we're running really low on time, so I'll quickly touch on this one. We'll come back here. All through the book, the kings are bad. You're starting to get that? There's no good kings in Judges. They're always the oppressor. The kings are the wicked, evil people who do horrible things to Israel. Which you would think by the end of the book, they would say, well, the one thing we've learned is that whatever else happens, we don't want a king. Because we've only ever seen bad kings. And here's how the story ends instead. The period of Judges ends with Israel saying, God, here's what we want. We only want one thing. We want a king of our own so we can be like the other nations. Going, I'm sure I'm not the only one who looks at that and says, how could you be so foolish as to wish for the very thing that for hundreds of years was the most painful part of your experience? And you ask God for the very thing that was a blight upon your nation. And then I apply it like this. Is it possible that we too look around at the nations, our neighbors, people who don't know God and are far from him, and we look and say, God, all I want is what they have. Like, God, I see my neighbor, I see what's going on in their life, and if I just had what they had, everything would be good. Be careful of wishing for what the nations have. The nations had a king. Israel wished for a king. It became the thing that would destroy them in the end. Be careful of that one. We will come back to that one. Last but not least would be this. Trust the promises, not the prophet. I think that's the issue that Deborah's wrestling with. It's like, Barak, you had the promise of God. You knew what he had said. You knew what he had asked of you. You knew what he was going to do. Why wasn't that good enough? Why did you need the prophet to show up with you? Because the prophet's nothing. The prophet's just the mouthpiece. And I think maybe I wrestle with this one. You find your favorite, for me, favorite author, favorite preacher. Preachers have favorite preachers. Your go-to person who you love, and then you put them just up a little bit at first, and eventually the pedestal gets higher and higher. And one day you notice that you've elevated the person, not the message. And the message almost can become a secondary matter to the person. And someone, if they attack your favorite person, whew, watch out. You're defending the person, not the message. And you've lost sight of the promise of God, and you've put your focus on the mouthpiece of God. And yes, we're to imitate godly leaders. Hebrews tells us that. We're to imitate godly, faithful leaders. But not all leaders are always faithful, myself included. Trust the promise. Trust the God who speaks the promise. Be careful of exalting the mouthpiece, because we're all broken.